Shane Sanders. I'm a postdoctoral associate at Mississippi State's Institute for Genomics, Biocomputing, and Biotechnology. That's based in the High Performance Computing Center over in the Research Park, and we also have a research lab here on campus. I'm also a PhD candidate in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering here at State, and should be finishing that degree up in July or so of next year. And you're going to have to bear with me because this VGA cable likes to make things fuchsia. But
rose-colored glasses.
So basically, a lot of my research is involved in DNA sequencing, DNA assembly, searching for sequence homology, genome annotation, that kind of thing. And I do a lot of computational biology and bioinformatics, obviously, and homology, sequence alignment, and BLAST are some of the key things that we use for that. So this is going to be a really brief overview through, you know, some of that. And I even have in-class exercises for us. So, all right, basic biology review. And I always like to include these because I don't really know my audience for these kind of talks. And some of the times I get a lot of computer science majors that, you know, their only biology was high school, basically. So we're going to start off. The genome is the genetic material of an organism. It's your DNA, your chromosomes, that kind of stuff. It's primarily responsible for heredity and, you know, variation within and among species. There are other factors that can play a role, environment, nutrition, that kind of thing. But, you know, the genome is one of the principal components of, you know, making you who you are, kind of thing. Genomes can be DNA in the case of most eukaryotes, you know, plants, animals, fungi, that kind of thing, insects, you know. It's a double helical molecule made up of four nucleotides, adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. In the case of some viruses, the genomes can be RNA. So it can be a single-stranded molecule. In some cases, some viruses are also double-stranded. And it's made up of the same four bases, except thymine is replaced with uracil. And basically, nucleic acids are translated into proteins. And the proteins are the workhorses of living organisms. They do things. They change molecules from one into the other. They catalyze reactions, that kind of stuff. So this is the central dogma of molecular biology. So you've got DNA, and DNA can copy itself and make copies of itself with DNA polymerase. And that's called replication. It can be transcribed into RNA, and actually with a RNA's polymerase, and that's called transcription. And from there, that RNA can be translated into proteins using ribosomes. And basically, in some cases, there's an arrow where you can go back from RNA to DNA in the case of viruses, and some molecular biology techniques will let you take things and splice them back into the genome using those kind of techniques. But that's the main overview of the biology. So, for our purposes, as far as bioinformatics and computational biology goes, and what we're going to cover in here, DNA and RNA can be thought of as a character string with an alphabet of four characters, G, A, T, and C. Now, for your double helical molecule, it's got directions on it. So you have a 5' strand and a 3' strand if you're going from left to right. And if you look at these, you can see they're complementary. So, you know, you've got your cytosine paired with your guanine, your thymine paired with your adenine, that kind of thing. And basically, since the 3' to 5' strand is the reverse complement, you know, it's basically the exact same thing in reverse and going in the opposite direction. The standard convention is only actually to work with the 5' to 3' strand if you're storing these in files, that kind of thing. So you've got your 5' to 3' strand, and since it's, you know, the convention is to represent it that way, or assume it is that strand, you just, you know, have that sequence. So you don't need both of them. It saves file space, that kind of stuff. Proteins, or the character string, can be thought of by character strings with alphabets of 21 characters. Basically, those are the amino acids. There are 21, or there's 20 standard, and there's an extra one that gets made in humans every once in a while. But these are the 20 chemical structures of them, and they all have one-letter abbreviations. So for bioinformatics and, you know, sequence homology and searching and BLAST and sequence alignment, we think of these as basically these 20 characters, strings with an alphabet of 20, 21 characters. And they're represented from the N-terminus, because there's a amine terminus at that end and a carboxy terminus at the other. So, and they're represented from the end of the T. All right, there's several standard file types that we work with. There are GenBank files, which is a file format derived from the National Center for Biotechnology Information. And it's a flat file text format. The entire thing is ASCII text, character-based. It provides a large amount of information about a given sequence record, and we can go look at one. see, where'd my mouse go? There it is. All right. All right. So let's see. You can actually see that you've got, it'll tell you how long it is, when it was actually put into the database. It'll tell you the organism. It'll tell you, you know, common name, sources. These are the accession numbers of it. So this is a database record that you can use to look this up. You can look things, you know, who deposited it, what the journal data, you know, this reference is from, that kind of thing. So you can actually use this to conduct some of your literature searches, that kind of thing. You can actually see when the submission was, and this would be it. You can look at this number, this here, for the date here, and up there, and actually see that, you know, they've updated the sequence song. And if you look further down, you can actually start saying, you know, they give you information about, you know, this protein is in this location on the sequence, you know, from nucleotide 687 to 3158, sorry. But yeah, it gives you a lot of information, and it's just basically a flat text file. All right. Okay. FASTA is another format that's used to represent nucleotide or peptide sequences. It's just a text file. Each record begins with a single line description, starting with the greater than sign, and then you can have, you know, sequence one from, you know, E. coli, sequence one, that kind of thing, followed by one or more lines of the sequence. And FASTQ files are pronounced FASTQ, and they're a text file format for storing nucleotide sequences and corresponding quality scores. These quality scores are derived from the laboratory equipment we use to generate these when we sequence the DNA. So basically, for each base or nucleotide of the DNA molecule, you have a corresponding probability that it's the correct base call. So did the sequencer get this right, and what it thinks is the actual, you know, quality score for that base. So FASTA format is kind of like I said. You've got the greater than line for your first one and kind of a description, followed by several lines of sequence. And this is a FASTQ file. So you basically have your sequence ID, your sequence, a blank line, and then you have a corresponding quality score. And you can have multiple of these in a single file. So you could have thousands of these one after the other, thousands of those one after the other in a single text file. And we'll go into a little bit more detail on what these FASTQ files are here in a second. So line one is the sequence identifier, and it can have information about the sequence. It can have information about the sequencing machine, the date it was sequenced on, the type of sequencing that was done, all kinds of different chemical information that's not really relevant to doing sequence alignment, that kind of thing. But it's there if you really get interested and you've got projects involved with that. Line two is your raw sequence, you know, just your nucleotides, GAT kind of thing. And line three is a other blank line, and you can actually put more description or sequence line there. It's generally not used. It's generally left blank. And line four are the encoded quality score values, and we're going to go through what these quality scores mean. So the symbols on that line four represent the quality of that base. So if we go back and look, this 5 is the quality score of this base, and that line is encoded, and I'll kind of show you what we got. There are a few different encodings depending on the sequencing platform, but Sanger is the standard, and it ranges from 0 to 93. So the higher a score is, the better it is, and the score is logarithmic. So basically, your quality score gives you that probability, and if you know what your quality score is, you can compute your probability. So this is the way they're encoded in text. So that's the exclamation mark is a 0, and it's just linear all the way down to here, which is somewhere around 60, 70, I think, at the moment. So basically, each one of these on line 4 corresponds to, you know, that'd be 0, 1, 2, 3, all the way up. And when you actually convert those, if your score is a 10, you've got a 1 in 10 chance of having an incorrect call at that. And, you know, 30 is 1 in 1,000, 40, you know, you can see it's logarithmic all the way up. And we generally work with sequences around, you know, quality score 28, 30, that kind of thing. We like to filter about there, so we've got a really good chance that the base is accurate. All right, so now that we know what general kind of file formats we're going to be working with, we want to talk about homology. So homologous sequences are genes related to another gene from descent from a common ancestral sequence. So what I'm showing here are three different proteins. They're different serine proteases. And these are molecules that basically kind of act like scissors on proteins. They'll take a protein and just chop it up at certain amino acids into smaller peptide fragments. And if you look at these three, they're all three different enzymes from cow, pig, and that's a bacterial sequence. And this is the one slide that needs decent color. Basically, you can see this is the amino acid chain, and these are some of the secondary structure features. So you'll have your alpha helices and your beta sheets here. And if you kind of just look at the overall trends of these, you can actually see that they are, you know, very, very similar and highly related. And, you know, you can think that they probably share a common ancestor, you know, several million years ago. You know, they're all different proteins. They have different amino acid sequences, but their structure is relatively similar all through there. You know, little alpha helix turn here, here, here. You know, this one has two, this one has one. Beta sheets in kind of the same corresponding area. So, you know, there are two main types of homology that people talk about. You have orthologs, and those are genes in different species that evolved from a common ancestral gene, kind of like I just showed, you know. Same type of function that's been passed on through millions of years of evolution. So you've got a gene and a common ancestor. At some point, those speciated into two new species, and you want to compare the differences between those two. You know, how much different are these two genes that are supposed to be really similar from these two species? Then you've got paralogous sequences. And these are genes related to duplication within the genome. So every once in a while, there'll be miscopy events or other random things that'll come through and, you know, actually cause a gene to get copied within the genome. And so you'll go from one gene to having two copies of it in the genome. Orthologs generally retain the same function in the course of evolution, but paralogs, they evolve new functions, even if these are related to the original function. Because you don't have pressure on the second copy at that point to actually keep making that same protein, so that second protein's a little bit looser to evolve and, you know, play with new functional representations. There are a couple other homologs that we need to talk about. There's homeologs. These are homologs resulting from the duplication of genes due to a whole genome duplication event. This is a lot more common in plants, and as an example of that, commercial cotton is, commercial cotton is got a duplicated genome. It has an A genome and a D genome. So there are other cotton relatives where they're just A genomes, just D genomes. But somewhere along the way, these two plants bred, and both genomes ended up being stored in the same cell and able to propagate, that kind of thing. And that led to the evolution of the spinnable fiber and everything else like we all wear. Onologs are very ancestral homeologs. So it's a term that's not really in common use. There was a push for it about 5 or 6 years ago. But you'll see it if you actually start looking at some of these things. That's why I included it. And there's a lot of pushback by the evolutionary biology community because because Ono basically was really trying to promote this word, and the rest of the evolutionary biology community didn't really like it. So they just still try to call them homologs. Xenologs are homologs that result from horizontal gene transfer between two organisms. This happens a lot in the case of smaller things like bacteria, nematodes in the soil, that kind of thing. They'll pass genes back and forth between each other and have duplicate copies. You know, not through sexual reproduction or budding or asexual reproduction, but they'll actually just send the genes back and forth to each other and have extra copies through other ways. So now that we've got a set of homologs that we want to look at, how do we want to look at them? Well, the standard way is to actually align these, and we actually take two sequences and compare them, or multiple sequences and compare them, and we look for the characters or character patterns that are the same. So for global alignment, you look at it and you basically want to find the matches along the entire sequence. So you want to use this for sequences that are quite similar. So they need to be similar in length, and you do an entire length-to-length alignment of this thing, of the two sequences. Local alignment, you look for pieces that are similar. So, you know, a small piece in a larger piece of the sequence, and we'll see some examples. So if we've got two names, Garvey and Avery, a global alignment of Garvey and Avery would be, you know, basically we gap the end here to align that, but you can see the A lines up, the VE lines up, and, you know, so that'd be a global alignment. It's not the best alignment, but it is an alignment, and you can see that they are, they do have some similarities, the A and the VE. All right, so now we're going to go through an example. And you guys can group up and everything, but all right, what you're going to want to do is you start at the first row, and you go through the columns. So you'll mark, you know, is there an A? So you'd mark here, you'd mark here, you'd mark here. And you do this for each row, each column. So A, same thing. For this, it'd be G. And what we're going to want to look for is where they have the longest diagonals in common with each other. So when you get it done, look for your diagonals, kind of like you're filling out a crossword, word search. And circle your diagonals, and then see if you can actually try and generate an end-to-end sequence alignment of this thing. Anybody got any idea? Got a guess? So those would be your diagonals. And at the bottom, I'm showing what a global alignment of these two would look like. So basically, you don't have any alignment for the first couple. So you basically gap, and you'd align these three, and you gap, and then you'd align these two, and then gap. And that's what we're representing at the bottom there. Okay, so that's kind of a feel for what a global alignment looks like if you're going to do one by hand. So why do researchers focus on sequence alignment? Well, they want to look to determine if there's any possible functional similarity between two sequences. So if you've got two sequences and you want to see, you know, are they similar, you know what one of these things does. You have a protein that does something and you've got another sequence you think may be related. You'll align those and see how closely they are. If they're the same length, are they almost the same sequences if you've just got two? Another thing they look at is, you know, is one piece of this, like it's the prefix or the suffix of one string, the suffix of another. So if you have two of these sequences, do they kind of overlap? And you can use those overlaps to actually do genome assembly and put things together if you've got a bunch of different pieces all from like one organism. Given a sequence, maybe somebody wants to know, do they have any other similar sequence anywhere else? Has anybody seen anything like this? You can do sequence alignment to identify the evolutionary history of a gene or protein. So there are people that have figured out, you know, they've got matrices for change. So basically, you know, the probability that a given nucleotide in a sequence will have changed over a certain number of years. Or you can just do it to, if you've got a sequence and you want to see if you can identify your gene or your protein. So the most common tool used by researchers as far as sequence alignment goes is BLAST, which stands for the Basic Local Alignment Search Tool. It was developed in around, I think, 1986 by Stephen Altschul at the National Center for Biotechnology Information, and it detects sequence similarity. It lets you identify unknown sequences, it's fast and reliable, and it is very flexible. There are a couple different versions of BLAST. So BLAST-N takes your sequence, and if you've got a nucleotide sequence, A, T, G, C, or U, and it searches a nucleotide database with your nucleotide sequence. BLAST-P does a protein database with a protein sequence. BLAST-X is a protein database, and you translate your nucleotide search query into proteins, and you search that. T-BLAST-N searches a translated nucleotide database. So you've got your database of, you know, your genomes or, you know, your chromosomes, that kind of thing. And it translates that into proteins, and then you search a protein sequence against that. And T-BLAST-X is basically doing a translated nucleotide database. So you've got your genome, and you translate that into proteins. And then you've got a DNA sequence, and it translates that into protein, and it searches those. So that it sounds confusing. It's not really. So this is the BLAST main page. So if you want to try and do one of these, let's see. Let me find my web browser. Back over here. You can just search for NCBI BLAST, and it'll be the first thing that comes up. So you've got your BLAST page. Let's say we want to do a nucleotide BLAST. We want to search a nucleotide sequence against a nucleotide database. So, where is this? All right. Let me go find a sequence. So we've got this unknown sequence. So what we're going to do is we're going to search this sequence and see if we can figure out what it is. So I'm going to cut or copy and go back over here to the BLAST. We'll paste the sequence in. Let's see. We're going to search against the nucleotide collection. That's basically all the non-redundant DNA sequences or RNA sequences they have in their database. We're not really concerned about which organism this is because we really don't know what our sequence is. And we're going to leave it with searching for highly similar sequences. MegaBLAST is a kind of variation of BLAST, which is used to do more genome scale things. So if you think you've got a chunk of a chromosome, that kind of thing. So we'll switch it to BLAST in, though. Just we want to see what's most similar to this. And you come down here and you hit BLAST. So it's going to start searching, and the page will update while it's searching. And the problem with doing these talks early in the morning is when all the researchers come into their offices and start sending sequences to BLAST to search. So when you do this in the morning as opposed to doing it at night, you know, at night, nobody's really searching NCBI, so, and yeah, it just reset on me. All right. So yeah, in the mornings it gets kind of difficult to actually get sequences back in any timely fashion, but it shouldn't take too long. All right. So, okay, this is what our results look like. All right. Okay, you get a color key for your alignment scores, and we'll tell you, you know, you can mouse over and see that what you've got. Like, red is a very good score. So we've got a lot of really good scores. So what's our first one? Homo sapiens, serpent, peptidase, inhibitor. And if we look through here, we can actually see the alignment. But you can see our query sequence that we submitted and the subject sequence. And you can actually see that there is pretty much a perfect alignment for all of that sequence. Let's see, where's my there, right. If we go back, we can scroll down and start looking at all the other identifications we've got. So we identified it again. Our sequence is very similar to the Homo sapiens one we just looked at, to a couple other proteins, to some pan troglodytes, that's chimpanzee. Makata, Makaluta, a lot of these are monkeys. Yeah, there's rhesus, yeah. So yeah, we identified our sequence and we've got a pretty good idea of what it is at this point. So what do these scores mean? So you see this max score, total score, query, e-value, accession, that kind of thing. So let me. All right, gone through that. All right. One of the things I want to point out, just so nobody gets overwhelmed or anything, is basically the page for the other types of blasts. Your standard proteins, your translateds, they're all pretty much the same layout. So you can just cut and paste your sequence in there and do your searching. So it's not really complicated if you're using their web tool to do it. There's our sequence, and it's available for download. There's our results. Okay. So the max score is how well those two sequences match. The total score includes scores from the non-contiguous portions of the sequence. So, like, where the gaps are. It includes, you know, if the sequence that we're searching against is really, really long, and our sequence is really small, or our sequence spreads out over a couple of them, it'll score both parts independently for the total score. The bit score is one of the things that researchers are commonly reporting these days. It's a log-scale version of a score. And basically it represents, say, if you've got a bit score of 30, you've got about a 1 billion independent segment pair. You've got to identify about a billion different pairs before you'll match that score. You'll get a score like that by chance. So each additional bit doubles the size of the search space. So the better your match is, the higher your bit score will be. And it actually means that you've got a really strong score. Query coverage is basically if you've got a sequence of 100 that you're searching, it's 100 in length. And it's basically how much of that matches your subject sequence, you know, what you identified against. Your e-value is how likely it can arise by chance, and your max identity is the match to the subject sequence with the highest number of bases. So we'll come and look at that over. Where is this? So, yeah. So we've got query cover, total score, identity, accession, and the e-values are pretty much perfect on these. And as we scroll down, and they order from best match to worst match, and most of these are pretty perfect. So, and it'll start telling us things like query coverage, and to get some of the things like bit score, you have to scroll down to the actual results. So, yeah, you can see your gaps, your identities, that kind of thing. So, and let's see if we've got any mismatches in here. Yeah. So you can see that it gapped the sequence some right there, but otherwise it's pretty much a decent alignment through there. And let's see. Yeah, that's another human protein, so okay. Yeah, and there's another gap there. All right. So dealing with the NCBI and their web interface gets annoying, kind of as you saw, like they can time out on you and everything else. So what a lot of people that do a lot of these things do you know, all the time is you install a copy locally and make your own databases and search against that. So the executables for BLAST are available online. I've got the URLs for you, and the documentation on how to run it is all available. So we're going to go through an example of that now. So if you got it, I use Linux for pretty much everything, but you can download this and do this in Windows. So let's see. So first we're going to download BLAST. So what I'm doing here is using a wget command. You give it a URL and it'll basically get the file from it for you. And we'll see how fast this goes. We're not going to wait for it to download. I've already got it. I'm not going to waste your time for 3 minutes of downloading. So, all right. So we'll assume we have that, what file is that? The NCBI Blast 2.2, blah, 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 tar.gz. So now that we've got that file, we need to unzip it. So it's going to be, in Linux, it's going to be tar.xzf NCBI. All right, so I've got it unzipped, and here, I'll drag this over. So, all right. So basically, this is the file we downloaded. This is the folder it created when we unzipped it. So in the folder is going to have your binaries. So you got tblastx, tblastin. Blast in, blast p, all the things we talked about. You got some commands to make databases, that kind of stuff. So you got your documentation, and it'll point you basically to the web, and they tell you how to do this kind of thing. So, so also in this directory, I've got a genome from an E. coli species. So we'll take a quick look at that. So yeah, basically this is a recently submitted genome for a strain of E. coli from China that causes some kind of disease in their food. So they sequenced it and uploaded it to the database so other researchers can use it. So this is kind of what the top part of the file looks like. And you can look at that using the head command. If you use the tail command, you can look at the bottom of it. So basically there are just a pile of sequences, FASTA sequences in this database. All right. Another thing, so this is what we want to make our database with. So to do that, we're going to use the makedb command that is in this binary folder right here, makeblastdb. So I'm calling the makeblastdb. Okay, our input is going to be this E. coli FASTA file, this genome. We're telling it that the database type is a nucleotide sequence, and we're telling it to basically just parse the sequence IDs. That way it'll give, when we actually search against it, it'll give us those accession numbers back. So, all right, let me go back. So, all right. So if you look at the folder here, it's relatively empty now. So when I hit this command and execute it, it's going to index this file and generate, it should have, yeah, research. All right. There we go. There, sorry. All right. So it generated these .nhr, .nin, .ndn, .nnd, and these are all index files into this to actually speed our BLAST search up. So another file we have in here is a set of unknown sequences. So we've got this proteins.fasta file. So we'll take a quick look at it. So we've got several protein sequences in this file. So what we want to do, since we've got a set of protein sequences and we want to search it against a nucleotide database, we want to do the tblastin version of BLAST. So the way you'd call that command would be All right, so I'm calling the T-Blast in executable. I'm telling it to use the E. coli database. Our query is proteins file. And so we'll run this. All right, so it basically did the blast for us without us having to wait. And if you can see, it should start showing the alignments and the gaps and gives us the scores for all the sequences in that file. So yeah, you can scroll up and see all that. Now, having this all output to standard out isn't really useful. So you can actually tell it to go and specify the output file. So over here, we now have this results.txt file. Let's see. So basically everything it just output over there, it gave us here. It's telling us what sequence we match against, what our scores are, what our alignments look like, that kind of thing. So. All right. So that's pretty much it as far as BLAST goes. There are a couple other online resources I'd like to point out. One is the University of California Santa Clara Genome Browser. It's basically a genome browser where you can take your sequences that you're interested in and search them against different genome sequences. They've got a wide variety of like common eukaryotes, humans, chimps, chicken, pig, that kind of thing. So if you're working with one of those types of sequences, you can search against those databases and it'll align your sequence and let you actually look at some of the overall structural features of the genome. So if we search this sequence, NP, whatever that is, against, I think this is a chicken? No, that's human, okay. So we search this against human, and you can actually see that here's an exon for this gene. So there are those your introns, and then you can look at the homology, you can see, you know, that, hey, we've got some other human genes like that. We've got some things in RefSeq. So it's a good resource to just actually look and get an idea of how complete your sequence is, you know, because some of this experimental techniques to get these sequences don't capture the whole thing. And getting a good idea of what you've got or how you put it together and if it's complete or not is nice to have. Another resource that is good to look at is the protein data bank. It's online, it stores a bunch of molecular structures for proteins, and it'll show you things like where they actually interact with other molecules, show you the 3D structures of them, that kind of stuff. And there's a couple other resources besides the NCBI website. There's EMBL EBI, which is the European Bioinformatics Institute, and the DNA Data Bank of Japan. Both of these regularly update sequence records with NCBI, but they provide a couple other tools as far as sequence alignment and neat little output things you can look at. The NCBI Sequence Read Archive has several, I guess, petabytes at this point of FASTQ files for different DNA and RNA sequencing projects. So you can pull things and look at those and actually do experiments with those if you want to. There's a wide variety of projects, you know, different tissues from human, different tissues from mouse, that kind of thing. We have a useful links page that we have. So we include links to basically, you know, several different places to do literature searches, people that'll actually do DNA sequencing library construction for you, places to look up sequences. If you're not sure what size, like if you've got an organism and you're not sure what the genome size of it is, you can look that up. You know, variety of resources related to plant databases, other stuff, you know. Different resources around campus. There's a couple different biotech companies that provide a bunch of different sequencing technologies, that kind of thing. And all right, and that's pretty much the overview of just sequence alignment and homology, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. And if you don't have any now but come up with them later, please email me or call me. My office is in the HPC building over in the research park across Highway 182. I'm there most of the time in front of my computer. So, and if you've got any questions, I'd be glad to try and help sort them out and point you in the right direction. Yeah.
I have a question about that. Can you find it?
Okay. Okay, is how likely an alignment can arise by chance. So it's kind of, evalues are kind of like probability, but I don't want to get murdered by statisticians in saying that, so I'm going to be a little bit careful there. But let's see, let me find an output. Alright, so these E-values are all zero, which basically means there's 0% chance, or zero chance that these alignments, the alignment of our sequence versus these sequences, arose by chance. You'll start seeing them, you know, increase from zero, you know, up to 10 to the negative. We generally cut sequence alignment values off at about 10 to the negative fifth. Like when you have an E-value that's 10 to the negative fifth or larger, we say that's an invalid alignment. But basically, if it's 10 to the negative fifth to zero, we call that pretty much a valid alignment. And it's basically the probability that something's going to arise by chance. But probability is a loose word when you're talking about E-values. So, anything else? All right, well, thank you, guys. And like I said, if you come up with any questions, I know a lot of you are working with Andy's group over the summer. You know, if you got any questions, feel free to shoot me an email, and I'll try and sort it out. Or you get bored and want to check out some computers, come across the highway. So.
Okay. For my group, and anybody interested in staying for the literature stuff, I'd say let's give us 10 minutes. That way I'll set up my computer. And then we'll just pick up with the EndNote and literature databases. And we'll wrap it up.